How's it going, guys? Kyle with Dirt Bike Channel here. You are listening to the Dirt Bike Channel podcast, and I have a pretty awesome treat for you guys today. I've got two guests, so it's a double whammy, or maybe it's a triple whammy. I don't know what you'd call that, because there's me here, too. So I've got Josh Knight here with me, and I've got Kevin Egbert, and we are going to be talking about ISDE, everything about ISDE tonight, this morning, whenever you're listening to this. I don't know. You might be listening to this in the morning, right? Maybe you're one of those early risers. Like Kevin, you're an early riser, aren't you, Kevin?
Yeah, 6:30.
6:30. Josh, how early do you get up?
Normally about 6:30, but in my 6 days prep, I'm trying to get up at 5:30 and be a little more disciplined.
Bust out three bib changes and
do some bib changes before breakfast.
Oh man, I used to get up early. But now with what I'm doing right now, I'm lazy. I stay in bed until I have to get up. So I'm bad. So let me introduce my guest tonight. I've got Josh Knight here. Josh Knight is a two-time ISDE gold medalist, and you also have finished with it. You're a silver medalist one time. You've done ISDE three times, International 6 Days Enduro, for those of you that don't know what that is. We'll get into a lot more of that. This is going to be your fourth time competing. It's coming up here in November, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Josh is he's also a National Hare and Hound 250 class winner. He's won that multiple times. Maybe not the championship. We can talk about that. But individual races, you've smoked everyone out there. And you're just all-around awesome dude. Raced a lot this year, qualified for ISDE, and you're going to be one of the club team members for 2019, right?
That is correct.
So, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, how all that process works. But that's coming up in November. And then Kevin Egbert here, he's also our guest tonight. Kevin is the owner of Moto Experts in Spanish Fork, Utah. It's a full service motorcycle ATV shop, everything from engines to suspension. You do it all, even sell bikes, right, Kevin?
Yeah, we do a bit of everything. We primarily do suspension and engines on the dirt bikes, but we've also we do quite a bit of the four-wheelers and the ATVs side by side,
yeah. So how much would I have to pay you to start sabotaging side by sides?
They do that on their own.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. So and Kevin is here because he's got a really awesome place in Josh's team this year as it relates to the bike, getting the bike to Portugal and getting all of that happening. So yeah, so that's kind of what we want to talk about today. We've got a whole host of stuff. We're going to learn a lot about ISDE. I'm not as well versed in this style of racing and in this format. And so Josh is going to be teaching me a lot of stuff as we go through this. And I think it's super interesting. There's a lot of aspects of this that I think are going to be interesting to the average rider. And that's who this podcast is really kind of targeting, is the average rider. We look at guys like Josh and we go, you know, maybe someday I might be able to ride, you know, it partly as good as he does, or you can pick out a section of a race and you can be like, someday I'm going to do what he did right there. For 30 seconds, I'm going to do what you did. And that's kind of where my listeners and me specifically, I've watched some of your races, on YouTube and things, and I'm going, that's a lot faster than me. And he's obviously got a lot more skill than me. So it'll be interesting to hear you kind of talk about how you prep for a 6 day event like this. So you guys ready?
Of course. Cool. Yep. Thanks, Kyle. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So Josh, tell me kind of just real briefly, how did you get started in dirt bikes? I mean, how old are you now, and when did you start riding?
I'm 24 years old. I have ridden dirt bikes since I was 4 years old. Most of my life. And that's a really interesting question. Lots of people ask me that, and I'm happy to share and kind of share a little bit about where I've come from and why motorcycles mean so much to me. I grew up pretty similar to everybody that I know, just growing up having fun. We would go camping. I think that many people that I know have been introduced to the outdoors or to riding motorcycles or four-wheelers by growing up camping with family and friends, and that is how I learned to ride a motorcycle. That is how I fell in love with motorcycles. That's how my family fell in love with motorcycles, was just growing up camping. We would go to many different places around Utah with family and friends. We would camp over the weekend and just ride. And I've done that since I was a little kid. As long as I can remember, we'd pack up the trailer, pack up the truck. We would go out to some of our favorite places and we'd just camp and we had fun. And that's where I learned to ride. That's how I progressed. That's how I just became to know this great sport, this industry that we all enjoy, was by camping and being outside with family and friends.
That's cool. How many kids were there in your family?
I'm the oldest. I have three siblings, two brothers, one sister, and then my parents. And then I recently got married this past year. I've been married 1 year to my wife, Jessica.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And so, yeah, that's people ask me all the time how I grew up riding and how I got into riding. And the number one answer to that is just going camping with my family and friends and riding with my dad and riding with my brothers. That's what we do.
Love it. Love it. So kind of a segue then, how often do you ride now? You've been riding for 20 years from the time that you were four, which makes me feel a lot better because I didn't start riding until I was like 29 or 30. So that's always my excuse for why I'm not as good as some other people.
Well, the problem with us is me and you both started riding on a four-wheeler.
That's true.
If we had started when we were like five or six on a dirt bike, we could be ISDE champions right now.
I think the real trick.
I wish though you hadn't brought that up, Kevin, because that's really embarrassing. Well, why do you have to like focus on the negative?
I feel like that was already in the open. Oh.
I think the real trick though is actually I skipped one step. I started dirt bikes when I was four. I actually had a three-wheeler before the PW50. Ooh. So that may be part of the equation, is to start on a three-wheeler.
No, I think that's probably why you're fearless, because those three-wheelers are freaking dangerous. Yes. Yeah. You know what I mean? So at least Kevin and I had the good sense to start on four wheels. I mean, we should have started on two, but three-wheelers are dangerous, man. There's a reason why they don't make those things anymore, right?
Yeah.
But
I was listening to your first podcast and it reminded me exactly of my upbringing. My dad had a DR350 that I would ride on with him. And he picked up a couple four-wheelers and I had a TRX 200, just like you said, all the way down was neutral and then up from there.
Yeah. And that set me back. So I don't, it's not that I don't let my kids ride four-wheelers, but I'd much rather have them on dirt bikes.
Right.
So that's a whole other podcast that I think I'll do, is should you put your kids on four-wheelers? My opinion is probably no.
We'll just settle that now.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no. Just put them on dirt bikes. So Josh, how often do you ride now? I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about ISDE, but let's say ISDE isn't even a thing that you're prepping for. How often would you ride? Like once a week, three times a week, four times a week? What's it look like?
That's a very good question, Kyle. I in my lifestyle right now, the things that I do and the way I live, I usually ride once a week. I'm currently a college student. I do work on the side. I spend lots of time with my family. And at the rate I'm going, doing the things that I'm doing, I usually try and ride on the weekends. I usually ride once a week. When I'm preparing for an event or preparing to race at a little higher level, I'll try and up the frequency and ride as much as possible. But once a week is pretty much about as much as I can ride with the schedule that I have. And so, I enjoy riding as much as possible.
I love that. The thing I love about that is, for most of my riding career, I probably was only averaging once every other week. And if you took it throughout the whole year, I was probably once every 3 weeks. People thought I was riding all the time because there was all these YouTube content but I didn't ride that often. Now I'm trying to ride once a week. Actually, I'm trying to ride like 1.5 times a week just to kind of get better at it. But it's nice to know that, you know, you don't have to be doing this every day to do. And that's one of the things I love about dirt bikes, is it's something that you can do on kind of a part-time basis and still improve, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, no, that's cool. So how'd you get started in racing? And then from there, I want to jump into this ISDE, what the format is like, and we'll jump into all that. But how did you get started in racing? We know that you were camping to kind of get started with dirt bikes, and a lot of outdoor stuff, you know, kind of sprung up because of that. When did racing become an interest for you?
So we always continued camping, enjoying the outdoors, riding. And when I was actually four, I think was the first time I participated in my first race. It was at the OCA motocross track, and it was a peewee race on the PW50.
So it was right away. You started riding at four, you started racing.
Yeah. But I would say where I really started racing was later. We continued camping. My dad would take us to a race or two a year, maybe three, just peewee races. We'd go out to just the race, or maybe we hit a race on our way home from camping or something. But it was very selective, and it wasn't that often, and it was never really. I still raced solely just for fun, but it was never out of a need of competition or anything. It was always just for fun, and so we continued that same frequency, just racing every once in a while, a couple times a year for a long time. My dad would just take us to a race here or there. We'd do a motocross peewee, maybe we'd do a desert race and peewee race, and that continued until I was about 12 or 13. I think when I turned 13 was the first year that I decided, and my dad decided, let's try every race this year. Let's go hit a whole series.
What series was it that you tried first?
Well, we first tried the USRA desert race.
Okay.
And I was on a KTM 105, I think, that year.
Okay.
That was the first year that I had raced, that we set out at the beginning of the year to do every race. And so that, for me, was the year that I guess racing kind of became a thing or begun, was that year. And I think that was 2009. I think that was the year 2009 when we began to actually race a full series and compete in a full series. And it was never with the intentions to do this as we do today. It was never, everything I've always done has always been just for fun. Mm-hmm. It's always been with my brothers, with my dad, and with our friends. And that's what we did that year. And this is where we are today.
Cool. So let's talk about ISDE now. We'll fast forward a few years, and you've done this. You're like the expert of ISDE, at least here for me in this room anyway.
I've watched some YouTube videos.
that's very good. What did you learn on those YouTube videos about ISDE, Kevin?
They're sending it like full triple size jumps that they're doing, and it's not even supposed to be triple size jumps. They just send it.
So Josh, tell us, what is the format of ISDE? What makes it unique to the lay person out there that doesn't know anything about it?
So first off, the ISDE stands for International 6-Day Enduro, like you introduced earlier, Kyle. Thank you. And it's an extremely unique format. The timekeeping enduro format that the ISDE uses is my personal favorite discipline of racing, and it provides the most joy for me. I think that it also fits my personality and my skill set very well on the bike, and so I perform a little bit better during those events than others, and that may contribute to why I enjoy it so much. The timekeeping enduro format, I sometimes share this example that I thought may help some of you listeners get a feel for how this format works in comparison to other races. And let's say that you are going to run a marathon. The timekeeping enduro format, it provides a sprint and an endurance section in the same event, in the same race. So it not only has sprinting and high intensity, but it's also an endurance event. And so the example I like to use is, let's say that you are going to run a marathon, and this marathon is divided into quarter segments. You have 25%, 50%, 75% of the way, and then completing the full marathon. And you have to complete the full marathon in an allotted time of 4 hours or 5 hours. Something that is a nice running pace, but not your full sprint. You have time checks along the way that you have to arrive at, and you have a schedule. You have to complete the first 25% of the marathon in 1 hour, half the marathon in 2 hours, and so on. You won't be penalized if you maintain your schedule. A term that's often used in enduros is staying on your minute.
Okay.
You have a schedule for the day. You have to cross through your check on time, and you have to cross through that first quarter at 25% exactly at 1 hour. If you arrive early, you'll have to wait until your minute comes up. If you get late, if you get there late, then you're penalized. So if you go through early, you're penalized. If you go through late, you're penalized. You have to go through on your minute. That's where the term staying on your minute comes from. So you complete...
Who sets the minute? Who sets that schedule?
So the organizers of the event will create a schedule for the event. They'll ride the course, and they will determine a schedule for each transfer section.
Okay.
So we'll apply these terms to the race here in a second, so it makes a little bit more sense. But they will determine the schedule. When you arrive on time, you won't get penalized. So the racing portion of that race is, let's say you run your whole marathon, and within that marathon, there are these 100-yard dashes every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Those will be your special tests. So you have to complete the marathon within 4 hours, and then you sprint the 100-yard dashes as fast as you can, and that's where your score comes from. So you complete the full marathon, and if as long as you complete the marathon within 4 hours, you zeroed. You didn't get any penalties, and you didn't get any score. Now you total up all of your 100-yard dashes, and that's your score. That is sometimes kind of an analogy that I use to share to people that are completely foreign to the idea. So during an enduro in a motorcycle environment, you will race transfer sections out through the mountains, going through roads or different areas, and arrive at these special tests. These are the tests where you are timed. This is where you go 110% and you sprint, and this is where you get your score. The other sections are referred to as transfer sections that are transferring you to and from these special tests throughout the day. So we'll race upwards of 150 to even 200 miles in a day, and we'll hit probably 6 to 8 of these special tests.
That's cool.
If you maybe have some questions, Kyle, that may help our listeners understand that a little better, that's something that I sometimes share to help explain an enduro.
Yeah, so these transfer sections, then they might be pretty long. I mean, it could be 10, 20 miles, it sounds like, right?
Yeah, they can be, yep, exactly, 10, 20 miles.
And how challenging, I guess it depends on the day and the area, because ISDE happens in different countries every year, right? How difficult are these transfer sections? It sounds like the sprints are probably pretty challenging, but the transfer sections, is that generally challenging, or is that kind of like your rest section?
For the pace of the race, the transfer sections will usually be more of the rest area.
Okay.
Based on the pace. As far as difficulty of the terrain, in my experience, sometimes in the transfer sections, you can actually have obstacles or terrain that's as difficult or even more difficult than some of the sections in the test. In the three ISDs that I've done, when I think of the individual most difficult sections and obstacles, they were actually in transfer sections in between these tests.
That you weren't even being scored on, but you were being penalized if you got there early or late.
Exactly.
Well, technically though, if you got there early, is that a penalty?
As long as you don't cross through the checkpoint.
Okay.
So you can arrive early. If you get there 10 minutes early, that's okay.
Okay.
But there is a designated checkpoint.
And then you just stop and wait for 10 minutes, you know, exactly. And then go through. Are these staggered starts, or are they a group start?
So the whole enduro format will be a staggered start.
Okay.
They'll assign 3 riders per minute. When the event starts, the first 3 riders will go. And then every minute after that, they'll send 3 more riders.
How do they decide the pecking order on who starts first?
Day one is random. And then after day one, it will be organized based on results.
Based on the results. Okay. So the cream rises to the top in day two and through on.
Exactly. Okay.
You were telling me previously about your ISDE experience in Argentina and how gnarly the sand section was. And how many riders ended up DNFing because of that?
Yeah, I In 2014, the ISDE was held in San Juan, Argentina. And I have experience, I'm from Utah, and I have experience riding in what I consider desert sand. And at the time, I thought I had experience riding and racing in silt conditions. I have ridden in Mexico, but I haven't ever actually raced the Baja 1000, but I've seen Dust to Glory, and I know that silt exists in Mexico. But up to this event in 2014, I had not yet actually ridden true silt. And there was day three, which will forever go down in ISD history as the highest DNF rate in the history of the event.
Did not finish, for those that don't know.
DNF or did not finish.
What happened?
There were sections throughout, out across the desert of Argentina that were 30 or 40 mile long transfer sections that was pure open desert. It was 110 degrees, and there was silt beds everywhere. We were crossing washes, and bikes were getting completely sunk in silt. I remember a specific transfer section riding with another U.S. team member by the name of Cody Schaefer from Colorado, and had we not worked together, he was either on my minute or 1 minute ahead of me in schedule, so we were really close. Had we not worked together to get through this section, I don't think either one of us would have finished. The dust was so thick, I remember running an air filter cover and the air filter, and after a couple miles, removing the air filter cover, then continuing with the normal air filter to the next checkpoint, and then setting two more new filters on there for the next section. It was that frequent.
You're riding with air filters, pre-oiled filters in your backpack.
Yeah, just to survive the transfer sections.
So I've got two other follow-up questions then. Number one is, it sounds like riders can help each other if they need to. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
What about spectators? Do you have any spectators? Can they help, or does it depend on whether it's a transfer or a challenge?
So that is a very good question, Kyle, because it actually kind of leads into another unique aspect of this event, which is that only the riders can work on their bikes. The mechanics can hand tools, but they cannot touch the bike through the entire week.
So you're doing the tire changes and all the maintenance and
exactly.
Everything.
So myself, I will be doing the tire changes and the maintenance. And so it's a very unique event in that it requires, I mean, riding skills and mechanical skills, but riders can help each other through obstacles like we did in that transfer section.
As far as the bike goes, you have to start the ISDE and finish the ISDE with the same, what is it, the frame, the cases, the wheels?
Yeah, there are specific parts on the motorcycle that cannot be replaced. That is the frame, the wheels, the case. There are other things that you can replace, exhaust system, tires, and different select parts, but for the most part, the main components of the motorcycle have to be the same to compete and finish in the ISD.
So that means you can't just go blasting through something and destroy the wheel or lose a spoke or whatever. You could. What about bearings? Could you change bearings out of a wheel?
That is a good question. I think that they use paint to mark specific components on your wheel, and they'll mark your hub.
Okay.
They'll mark your engine case. And so bearings may not actually be included in that. And if you had the ability to do that, then you may. Another, as we continue through this discussion, another element of the ISD that rises is the time limits on the work periods. Each day when you start the event, your motorcycle is kept in impound over the night. And if you are starting the day, you receive your schedule for the day, and let's say you start at 9 o'clock, you can go into impound and retrieve your motorcycle 10 minutes before your start time. So you have 10 minutes to work on your bike in the morning.
Well, what do you have at the night, though, to prep it for the next day?
And then you have 15 minutes in the
evening. Are you freaking kidding me?
So you have to take your bike out of impound and in 10 minutes get ready for the day. So usually you try and do most of your maintenance in the evening so you're not rushing in the morning. Start your schedule, race all day, 7 to 8 hours, finish the day exhausted, and you have 15 minutes from the moment you cross the checkpoint line to get your bike into impound. And riders will do 2 moose bibs and an oil change and sometimes a filter in 15 minutes.
And so they, holy crap. I just thought of that right now. I just thought of doing 2 bibs. So the wheel, these wheels have to go on the bike and then it has to go in impound. And after it's in impound, I mean, what, you could maybe put wheels on another, or what if you had a spare set of wheels? Could you have a spare set of wheels and then?
So you can't actually have a spare set of wheels because wheels are marked.
That's
so you
right.
have, you can have a new tire with a new moose bib prepped and ready to go.
Okay.
But the process includes lubed and ready to go. And the process includes putting the bike on the stand, removing the wheel, taking the old tire moose bib off and replacing it with a new tire and a new moose bib, and then putting the wheel back on the motorcycle.
It's so funny that to hear you say this, because I've seen a number of YouTube videos of different riders doing this, but I didn't know why. I'm like, oh, look how fast he's doing this.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw people handing tools to, say it was Cody Webb or Taylor Robert or something, but I didn't even understand why this was happening. Is this new? Kevin, you're more plugged into this. This isn't news to you, right?
No, but I can't wrap my mind around doing 2 moose bibs, even prepped in 15 minutes and putting the wheels back on. But
well, and the first 3 times that you've done this race, Josh, you were on 250F. So were you doing oil changes too? Dropping oil out?
Yeah, I would usually do oil, I think in my experience, every other day. You can choose and prepare for what bike maintenance you're going to do. Hopefully with the Team USA crew and your crew, that your pit crew that's there to help you. Usually you'll prepare for each day and have a plan going into it and know what things you're going to do. When I was talking earlier about arriving to your checkpoints throughout the day on your schedule, those are also service checks. So you can include those 10 minutes that you were referring to earlier when you arrive early to a check. Those are also work periods. They're usually out in the mountains, but Team USA does a great job of providing all the tools and oils and fluids that we need out along these service checks. And so you're able to work during those periods as well.
So things like levers, like you might be able to replace a clutch lever or something if you broke it off, or maybe a radiator hose or something.
Exactly.
So they need to know obviously what bikes you have in advance so they can have some of these parts. That's fascinating.
Right. So what is it? KTM and Husqvarna has factory support. They have just about every motorcycle part available from the last few years.
Exactly.
So that's why the majority of the ISDE racers have Husqvarna and KTM at these events, is because of the level of support that they have.
I was going to ask about that because I noticed that the trophy team, they were all going to be on KTMs. And your club team, everyone's KTM Husqvarna?
Yes, on my club team. I know that one of my club members is riding a KTM as well.
Okay. That is so fascinating to me.
So that's why he didn't want to ride the RMZ 450 at ISD.
Why he didn't want to ride your bike.
When Kevin stepped up to help, and which I can't really put words to how grateful I am for, but I did tell Kevin that I would ride any motorcycle if somebody were to provide it to me. But after we got discussing and planning, we talked about more details, and we did discuss the factory support that Husqvarna and KTM can have in Europe at this event. And so I'm happy with our choice.
Yeah, it was just pure logistics. That was the main reason he didn't want the RMZ.
I don't think we even need to cover that anymore. I mean, right. Why not? What, I've seen your bike. It's pretty trick, you know?
Right.
So that's a perfect segue into one of my other questions here, is why the 2020 250XC TPI? Talk to me about what led. Obviously, you guys both made that decision, but I don't think Kevin would have forced you into a bike that you weren't going to be comfortable on. So, talk to me about the 250.
And I think we originally discussed doing the 2019 250 XC with a carburetor because that's what he's been riding and that's what he's used to. And there's still some variables and unknowns with the TPI system that we were a little bit timid about. And we had one on order reserved, but the date kept getting pushed back for that 19. Just so happened a 2020 250 XC TPI came in, and Rocky Mountain ATV down in Washington or St. George, they offered that to Josh. So we went ahead and picked that up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. So how comfortable, how much you've been able to ride the bike? Well, actually, let me have you answer that question as well. Like, why 250 versus, you know, maybe a 300 or even a 350 XCF or something? Like, what pushed you? Because I did notice that a lot of the trophy team guys are riding the four strokes in this specific format. So what caused you to want to do the 250? Other than, was it just because you're comfortable because that's what you've been riding?
Yeah, there are a lot of factors that contribute to me riding the 250 and
two stroke here. This will be your first time on a two stroke too.
Yeah, this will be my first time competing in the ISDE on a 250 two stroke.
Right.
In the total experience of my racing career, most of my racing has actually been on a two stroke.
Nice.
Just ISDE has been mostly on the four stroke. I really enjoy.
Was that because of the rider support at the time?
That was mainly just due to the bikes that I was racing at that time.
Okay.
And the bikes that my brothers and I had.
Okay.
At that time.
Because we're talking several years ago.
Yeah, the last time that I competed in the ISD was 5 years ago.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
And that was a 250 XCF?
Yeah, that was the last time I competed, I was racing a 2013 KTM 250 XCF.
Okay.
This year, we will be competing on the 2020 KTM 250 XC TPI.
That's a long one. A
lot of mouthful there. But the reason I choose the 250 over the 300 for my personal preference for riding and racing and for the 6 days, it mainly comes down to my preference on the power delivery. And the thing that is most noticeable to me is the speed at which the motor can spin up. That to me is one of the biggest factors why I choose a 250 over the 300 for my personal preference. If you were to have the discussion of which one's better, it really all comes down to what you enjoy and what you want in your dirt bike when you're riding the trails, because both bikes are absolutely amazing. And so for me, I really enjoy the speed at which the 250 motor can spin up when I'm racing, when I'm coming out of a corner, when I'm approaching a section that I need to get that motor in the high RPMs. I enjoy how fast the 250 motor can spin up and get to that pace.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I own both of these bikes. I've got a 250 and a 300 2020 TPI. And I, most of the time, I prefer the 250. You know, there's a couple of times where the 300 is helpful for me in some of the trickier terrain. But if I had to choose just one of them and had to sell the other one, I'd keep the 250. And so, I love to hear you say that, talking about how the motor spins up, because it's a subtle difference, right?
It is.
But hey, in these, especially at your level, a lot of these subtleties are what can really make a big difference. You know,
I think you and Rich Larson talked about this in one of the last couple episodes, right? Where you asked him about the difference if he's limited riding a 250 versus a 300, and it was not at all. You just have to ride the bike differently.
Yeah, just slightly differently. And he was doing some of the things. I mean, it was one of those times where I was with a person who was doing things on a bike that I hadn't ever seen before, and just how easily he was doing it. I think that was part of it. I'd seen people do some of the stuff that he was doing, but just to string it together one after another so effortlessly, you know. And most people would say you need a 300 to do that. And you don't, you know, it comes down to your riding style. So I love that. So Josh, what things do you do in order to prep for a 6-day race coming up. I mean, it's in 6 weeks. In 5 weeks from now, probably less, you might be on a plane. How do you prep for that? I mean, it's in another country. So in the next month, you know, 6 weeks to a month, what are you going to do to prep for this? How often are you going to ride? When do you show up? Talk to us about that.
It really, for me, is very personal for the lifestyle that I live and the things that I do. So this may vary a lot between other athletes at this same level or other participants of the ISDE. But for me, what I'm doing now is doing the best. I remember in my experience riding and racing, Kurt Caselli telling me how he prepared for the ISDE and some of the things that he did. And he mentioned to me that he would try and do as large of trail rides or big days as possible, as well as train on a motocross track to maintain his sprint speed. As far as riding goes, he would do a mix of motocross sprinting and long days on the bike. Those were the two things that he focused on to help him prepare for 6 days on the bike. I do a similar mix. I am lucky enough to live nearby a motocross track. The OCA motocross track is about 10 minutes from my house. We've been members there for almost 20 years. And so I take advantage of the opportunity to train at a motocross track to maintain that sprint speed. On the weekends, I try and hit whatever race my brothers and my dad and I are going to go do, or go for a really long trail ride. My favorite thing to do is just trail ride in the mountains and ride single track. And so we'll just do long trail rides. We just got back from riding in Idaho, doing a multi-day trip up there. And when I was riding and after the trip, I couldn't think of a better way to prepare for the ISDE than spending 8 hours on the bike a day riding out in the mountains. That was what we were doing. So as far as riding goes, those are the things I'm doing. I'm trying to monitor my diet and nutrition a little bit closer. I am visiting and going to the gym. I'm trying to work on my physical conditioning, doing cardio and resistance training, and kind of building my own program that fits with the lifestyle that I'm living right now, balancing a lot of different opportunities and responsibilities and different things that I do in my life.
That's cool. So what are some of these, what's your workout regimen like then? Because that was one of the things I wanted to touch on later, but you already kind of hit it here. You said there was a mix of cardio, there's resistance. Is there any weight training? Maybe give us kind of like, obviously we don't need to know all the secrets, but generally what do you think are the most important things to do to stay in dirt bike shape?
For me, this is something that is very important to me, and I'm glad you asked that, Kyle, because something that honestly one of the biggest driving motivators in my racing career over the past 8-10 years has always been my physical conditioning. I have always recognized that I have speed on a motorcycle, or I think that all of us in this room and anybody that is listening to this right now, you can imagine your highest capability on your dirt bike and imagine if you could maintain that pace indefinitely, or at least for an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours or however long you need to. Imagine going your fastest pace as long as you needed to. That to me was always a driving factor for physical conditioning, to get in better shape, because I knew that I could go fast on a motorcycle. I knew that I could ride well. All it came down to was being able to sustain that for longer. You don't have to learn anything new on your bike. You don't have to even get any faster. You only have to get more physically fit and ride faster for longer. So I guess that's some of the motivating factors and some of the reasons behind working out and getting in shape. Some of the things that I do that I find work best for me are circuit trainings, doing resistance training at the gym at my university or any gym near your house. I find that doing resistance training, maybe similar to CrossFit workouts that have a mix of resistance training with some cardio to get your heart rate up and build those muscle groups that are triggered when you're riding. Focus on having strong core so you're supporting yourself on your bike, and strong legs and strong upper body to hang on and maintain the proper form while you're riding. But I do a mix of those sorts of things and cardio and watching the way I eat. And the most important thing that I think I've learned in my racing experience is what works for me and what works for my body type. That's what I would recommend to anybody listening, is to experiment. Find what helps you and find what works best for your body type.
So Josh, the most impressive part to me about the whole 6 days format is the mental strength. I think all of us watch Supercross and Motocross, and we can see how so many riders out there buckle mentally. They have all the speed in the world, Tomac. And I can't imagine how you are able to maintain that level of mental strength and endurance for like one day, much less 6 whole days of hard enduro.
I'm glad you brought that up, Kevin. That is something that is another aspect of our lives and our experience in riding and racing dirt bikes that is absolutely crucial and extremely important. And I feel, based on the things that you just shared and probably some of Kyle's thoughts and my personal thoughts, is one of the absolute most important things is our mental conditioning and our mental strength. Racing the ISDE is one of the hardest things that I've ever done in my life. And competing in an event of that scale and racing on day one or day two and going through difficult things and pushing through those barriers and those walls, knowing that you're going to have to do this not once, not twice, but 3 or 4 more days in a row is extremely difficult. And I think that a more important lesson that we can all learn from that is the benefits that these experiences can provide into our personal lives and into our families, is the things that dirt bike riding teaches us have, they've gone across every facet of my life, and they've helped me in my relationships. They've helped me in my family and all these different things that we learn. So I'm glad you brought that up, Kevin, because I feel that that's something that it's important to me, and it's important that we share those things about dirt bikes and what they've done for us and what they can do for us.
I love that. And that's something that I try to teach my boys, is just, we're going to do hard things. And I'm starting small, you know? And I wanted to ask you that question. What is tougher with ISDE? Is it the physical side or the mental side? And you may be able to make arguments for both, but if you had to say, which is more difficult, the mental or the physical?
That's a great question. I feel that for me personally, in my experiences in my life, usually thinking about doing something is harder than actually doing it. And I would say that in my experience racing the ISDE, it's an extreme event. It's 6 days long. It's over 1,000 miles sometimes. And it's over some of the roughest terrain I've ever ridden on a dirt bike. And it is physically demanding. There's no doubt about that. But I would say comparable to that, and it may actually be more, is the mental conditioning that it requires to compete and to sustain that level of physical endurance for that long, it can actually be more difficult mentally.
I think it'd for sure be more difficult mentally, and I think it starts with physical fatigue. You start to ache, you go down, you have some crashes, you know, blisters on your hands. It could be just very simple things that start to compile, especially after a few days of just rigorous 120-mile days. I mean, I've done desert races that are not even 100 miles, and I can barely walk the next day, much less think about riding a dirt bike for the next week. So that just me trying to imagine putting myself in that situation, it's overwhelming. And then especially having that much pressure, you know, it's a big investment to go overseas, to send a bike, to go through all this preparation, and then to know that you have all that pressure on you to, you know, push through for 6 days, no matter what.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like I was sharing earlier with my experience in riding and racing, the number one most important reason why I ride and race every week is for fun. It provides joy to my life. It's the best thing that I do. I love it. I absolutely love riding and racing motorcycles, just like the other two men sitting in this room. It provides so much joy to our lives that that's the motivating factor to me. And so when it really comes down to it, that's why I continue. That's why I continue to compete and do these things, and is all just for fun. It really comes down to just having fun.
I love that. I was just filming a video today. It'll come out in a couple of days, probably before this podcast comes out. And I was just kind of joking around about two-stroke versus four-stroke. And the gist of it came down to, it really doesn't matter. What matters is this sport, we're doing this for fun. And if you have more fun on one platform versus the other, then that's the better one for you right now. Because the whole idea is to have fulfillment. This is supposed to be recreational. You know, there's a few people that are going to do this for a living. The Eli Tomacs of the world, or the Cody Webbs, or, you know, Colton Hakers, Graham Jarvis. And then there's the rest of us that are doing this because of the joy of it. And I'm not saying that they're not doing it because of the joy, but, you know, we're not going to make $1 million riding a dirt bike, most of us. So we have to do it for the love of it. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So Kevin, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the decision to sponsor Josh with this bike for ISDE. Talk to us about how that came about. How long have you guys known each other, and where did this idea come from to, hey, let's have moto experts provide a bike?
So I don't think I ever really met Josh face to face until after we decided that we were going to help him. So when I started our shop in 2016, I started to get more involved in the desert racing, and pretty much immediately started hearing more and more about the Knights, the Knight family, and Mike and Josh and your brothers. And it's never been, I mean, it's always been very positive, good things about them and how they will go out of their way to help anybody. Just very positive. They put out a lot of, I think you guys GoPro just about every race that you do. So, I mean, the decision for me was pretty easy. It just took the phone call from Josh to say, hey, I'm going to 6 days and looking for any support. So started asking some questions. Well, what bike are you taking? Well, I don't know. It's up in the air. Okay. What if we provided you a bike? And he seemed pretty excited about that. And we got talking, and you know, one thing led to another, and we went down, we picked up the bike, and then, I mean, we took care of doing the suspension setup, the tuning, the testing, which that was the biggest part that took the most time, just because it's a very unique format, the 6 days, because you have some very tight technical, and then you have some, you know, high-speed big jumps, and So the suspension has to be tuned, you know, very well to handle both ends of the spectrum. So, and then I actually set up his bike that he has now with an identical setup so that he can continue testing, and getting, accustomed to clicker and, external adjustments so that he can, you know, make those on the bike over in Portugal.
That's a cool idea. So you did the setup on his 2019 250 XC.
It's a 2017 that you have.
Yeah, the current bike that I'm racing is 2017. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So it's identical setup on the suspension. So that's cool.
On the 20, the only differences are we have some different coatings on the suspension, but the internals, the valving, Racetech Gold valves. And then the spring rates, the oil, it's all identical.
That is very cool. Did you use the tiger sperm that Ricky Bobby has, or
yeah,
is that
from like Bangladesh?
A trade secret?
No,
it's not Ricky Bobby. It's Ronnie Mack. Yeah. Ronnie Mack. Sorry, mixing up.
Yeah, we would do that, but the TPI it automatically injects the.
That's right.
Yeah,
I forgot about that.
We don't have to do the premix anymore.
I forgot.
But it would be I guess we could run through the all the stuff that we did to prepare your bike. I mean, it's not a stock 2020 250 XC TPI that we sent over. There's quite a few changes that we made to it for protection, and then some for performance, and so we had to add some lights, and it has to be somewhat street legal. Not, it doesn't have to have blinkers or anything like that. But
yeah, the ISDE tech inspection requires semi street legal setup. We will run a headlight, a tail light. We do not have to run blinkers, and we will have to run a small horn and a small mirror to pass tech inspection. The event is usually held at a venue that is large enough to support the pit crews of 30 plus countries, and so it needs to be a very large venue. And usually, to get a venue that large, it's pretty close to a city or a major city. And so to get out to the course where we will be racing, the initial part of the transfer sections may be on highway, it may be on asphalt. To get out to those smaller countryside roads that will then lead us and transition out into the mountains and the hills. And so the event covers all sorts of different terrain. We'll be on road all the way to the gnarliest of single track up in the mountains with rocks and water and logs. And we added a few protective parts, a skid plate and some breakaway levers and other select parts that we felt were the best suited for the event that we're going to be participating in,
like swing arm tab guards, rear disc guards. What are some other things?
Yeah, Kevin knows probably better than I do some of the exact parts that we added, but we did add some of those protective parts, like a rear disc guard, a shark fin for the rear brake rotor, skid plate, the breakaway levers. And a couple other parts. We added a recluse clutch cover and a slave cylinder cover. Those are billet aluminum versus I think that the stock covers
the
are
cast.
Yeah, the cast ones that may shatter on impact, and so the aluminum will get a dent, but still be still able to tolerate the terrain after that.
And we also added like axle poles just to shave seconds off
quicker.
Yeah, for the tire changes.
It's still the manual clutch, though. It was just the recluse clutch cover.
Yeah. All stock internals,
okay.
Stock basket, fibers, steels. We just swapped out the cover, and recluse actually provided these parts to us just for sponsorship.
Yeah.
And then they also provided us their billet recluse slave cylinder, which... On this model, KTM hasn't been so failure prone like the Husqvarnas of previous years. And then I think we did a AXP composite skid plate, rotor guards, guts, provided a seat cover, GPR, got us a stabilizer and the complete upper triple clamp. So it's the pro mount that doesn't add any height to your handlebars. Radiator guards.
The billet aluminum radiator guards were
FMF gave you an exhaust system. So yeah, it'll be, should be pretty bulletproof, knock on wood, but I think we tried to attack all of the critical areas that could potentially cause catastrophic issue, but we didn't want to go adding unnecessary weight to the bike.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a fine line with that. I feel like sometimes less is more.
Exactly.
You know, and you guys could maybe riff on this a little bit. I feel like on these bikes, most of them are designed so well, regardless of what color it is, there's not a lot that we have to do generally other than some protective parts, you know?
Right.
Clutches are usually fantastic, you know, wheels are fantastic, bearings, those types of things. So I put a lot of protection parts on my bikes, but I don't put a lot of other, quote, upgrades.
Exactly. Right. It's a very fine line, and it's an interesting process, kind of analyzing the cost and benefit of each part that you're going to add. And so it's very important to me. It was important to Kevin to think through what we're going to need, what parts are going to add weight, what things are going to benefit us. And I think that we, in our discussions and planning, did a great job of choosing those parts that are going to benefit us the most, and add the least amount of weight. Like you said, Kyle, these bikes, especially KTMs and Huskies, they're bulletproof. They're strong. I'm absolutely amazed at what we can put these dirt bikes through, and the way they hold up is just absolutely astounding to me. The things that they can tolerate in the mountains and in the desert is just unbelievable. And so I'm extremely confident in the bikes that we purchase nowadays.
Yeah, well, and a question I have for you then is, what tires are you going to run? So you're obviously going to run Moose Bibs because you can't have a flat. So what's your tire of choice?
So that's a great question for the ISDE. We actually are required to run what's called an eco tire, and that's a bit of an oxymoron because a tire is on a dirt bike is going to go in the dirt and it's going to tear up the dirt. But they do have regulations on the tires that you can run during the ISDE, and these are eco tires. They have a shorter tread height on the knobbies.
So it's a half worn out tire.
So it's pretty much starting with a half worn out
like
tire.
A shorter knobby 505.
Yep. Larger gaps in between the knobbies and shorter knobbies, and a much softer kind of gummy compound, similar to some of the softer compound tires that are being released today. So it's not as good of a tire as your Dunlops or your other new motocross tires, but it does kind of put a filter on what everybody's going to be running. So it is interesting when changing the Moose Bibs. These eco tires that I'll be running, to answer your question, are going to be manufactured by Metzler. Metzler tires are the number one choice at the ISDE. I would estimate probably 80% of the racers will be racing with Metzler tires and Metzler Moose Bibs. Here in the States, I run different tires. I don't run eco tires here in the States. That is strictly for this event based on the regulations.
Because when you're here, you don't care about the environment. You just want to tear it all up, right?
Well, we're dirt bikers.
No. I just want to, for clarity, we care about the environment. We just, hey, we want to put a tire on that hooks up.
We want to see the environment. That's why we ride dirt bikes.
Right. It's always funny to me when it's like, oh, we're going to use these tires that are, quote, eco tires, because... And then we're going to put you through the hardest race we can find.
Exactly.
Through the hardest places. If you were really concerned about the environment, you wouldn't have these bikers run through these really hard places, because right. Then they wouldn't spin. But yeah. They're purposely taking you through things where they think this is going to be hard for them to get through. They're going to be spinning. And, oh, we're going to handicap them with like half worn out tires.
Yeah, we're going to give you a tire that doesn't hook up. So you're going to create deeper ruts anyways.
Exactly.
And then you wear them out sooner. So you have to just go through more tires and
you're using more rubber and exactly. effects. Yeah.
So you could have a whole another podcast discussing the economics of the tire choice.
The eco tire.
What was the gearing we wound up on?
So the it's interesting, Kyle, because in one of your earlier podcasts, you were discussing your 250, your 2020 250 TPI and how they changed the gearing. To compensate for a slight difference in the
they geared it down one. They went up to a 51 tooth in the rear.
So the stock gearing on the 250 XC models previous to 2020, I think, was a 13 front sprocket and a 50 on the rear.
Right.
And in 2020, they changed it to a 51. During our testing, we tested the 51 and the 52, and we actually ended up going with a 50. And so I have spent the most time riding with a 1350 setup because I am currently riding a 2017 KTM and I have probably over 4 years experience racing that setup.
Yeah.
And I figured that that would be the safest bet to continue although we do have the slight difference in the power delivery in the motor, I still felt it's a better decision to go with the 1350 based on my experience with it.
Right. Oh, I love that.
And we didn't want to do anything to the motor to adversely affect the reliability, longevity through the 6 days, especially with as little time as we have testing on the TPI motor. We opted to not swap out the head for like the RKTech or a Slavin's head. Or play with the compression or the piston. We just wanted to keep it 100% stock with the exception of adjusting the power valve screw or the power valve spring.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Do you know what the general elevations are going to be for these rides?
So the 2019 ISDE will be held at Portimão, Portugal, which is a coastal city. And so I expect most of our riding to be between 500 to 2,000, 3,000 feet maybe when we get up the in the highest hills. But I wouldn't expect anything more than 3,000, 4,000 feet.
Yeah, well, I think that'll perform really well. I my personal feeling is these bikes don't need more compression unless you're getting up to super high altitudes. A lot of the places we ride here in Utah, we can be up in the, 10,000, 11,000 feet. And then it helps a little bit to have a little more compression, but if I'm down lower at sea level, I don't really see the advantage of that.
I mean, it's nice to have the extra power, but when you've been racing as long as Josh has, when it comes to your times, having a little bit more compression really doesn't shave any time off. He's able to ride the bike, cater his riding style and technique to the power delivery of that bike. So,
yeah, that's very interesting that you mentioned that, Kevin, and it actually kind of sparked some thoughts on some of your earlier podcasts, Kyle, where you were discussing some similar topics with Rich Larson about the capability of a specific motorcycle or a specific displacement of a dirt bike. People ask me all the time. I've raced a 250 two-stroke for a long time, and I spend a lot of time thinking about maybe how I would perform on a 450 four-stroke at this level at some of the desert races or maybe at some of the enduros. I choose a 250 two-stroke because it fits my riding style the best for all the different types of riding that I do as of right now. But I also enjoy dirt bikes so much that in the future I will try all sorts of different types of displacements and different motorcycles to have fun on. But one of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about is if we ride our dirt bikes to their full capability. And I think about this mostly on a personal level, on my skills and on my speed on a dirt bike. I still go out and I'll go ride in the mountains or in the desert on the track on a KTM 250 two-stroke, and I still feel like I can't quite ride the bike to its absolute fullest potential. And so that to me is motivation to continue riding that same displacement and to continue to get better because I know that this bike still has more. And so I think that for those riders that are maybe more concerned about what bike they're riding or getting into riding, that so much of this is just on your ability to enjoy your motorcycle and have fun and push your bike and see what it can do, because it amazes me what a 252 stroke can do.
Yeah, it reminds me, I've had a chance to ride a little bit with Shane Watts. A lot of the listeners probably know who he is, you know, legendary motorcycle racer. And one of the things that he said at one of the trainings I went to was that someone asked what was his favorite bike, you know, favorite displacement. Everyone's there with bikes, everything from, you know, in that class, the smallest bike we had there was a 200, but, you know, on up to 500, you know, CC bikes. And there was a guy with a 650, had like a DR 650 or whatever. And they said, what's your favorite bike? What's the favorite displacement? And he said, it's 125. And he raced the 125, you know, he did a lot of that. And the follow-up question was, well, why? I mean, wouldn't you rather be on a 300 or a 250 or something like this? And he's like, hey, look, these other bikes are great, but I like the 125 because it's the one that I have been the closest to maxing out its potential. Anytime that I've ridden a bike, 250, 300, anything bigger than that, he's like, I'm not coming close to maxing its potential. And that isn't as rewarding to me, you know, which was a really interesting thing. And Kevin, you've had a chance now to ride with Shane a number of times. And he would come out there with a TTR 230. You and I rode his bike and about killed ourselves.
Not just any TTR 230, completely clapped out, like has no business being outside of a shop TTR 230.
Right. And he would just kind of humble us.
Yeah.
And not even try and just completely humble us, right?
Right. And it's actually interesting you bring up Shane Watts and the 125, because I think I don't remember what year ISDE it was, but he was the first rider to ever win overall ISDE on a 125. And I think there might be a couple riders since then, but it's amazing to watch any video of that guy ride on the 125.
Yeah. It's so, I love the idea that, look, most of us are never going to max out the potential of any of these bikes. We may want, you know, if you buy a 125, you may quote outgrow it in a year or two, but it's really only outgrowing it in your mind. You may want to try something different, but it's not because you've maxed out the potential. I mean, I guess if it's maybe a trail bike or something like a Honda, you know, CRF 110F or something, yeah, you can maybe max that out. But by the time we get to some of these race bikes, 125 race bike, 250 race bike, whether it's four stroke or two stroke, the idea that the average rider is going to max it out is kind of a real thing.
And some of you might be thinking, oh, I can max out a 125 or a 250 or a 450, but we're not referring to a straight line performance or out at the sand dunes climbing a, you know, sand mountain. This is single track or motocross track or any other discipline when there are turns involved, learning how to carry the momentum and feathering the clutch, using the power to its fullest capability. I mean, you just have to go and watch a James Stewart video on a KX125, and that's maxing out the potential of a bike.
Yeah. So perfect segue here, Josh, you know, cause this podcast, there's a lot of average weekend warriors type people. That's who I'm, you know, specifically making these for. Even the casual desert racer, he might, you know, race the USRA series or something like this. But they're a weekend warrior. It's the kind of guy that rides maybe once a week or maybe even just once a month. What are the things that you think are best for that rider to focus on as far as to build their skills? We've maybe talked about some of these things, but if you're just the casual guy, the weekend warrior, what would you best focus on as far as technique or what is it? What should we be focusing on? Like the Kyle Brothersons of the world.
Well, I'm going to answer your question in two ways, Kyle. One, larger portion to directed towards that audience that is your major audience, mostly more adults that are participating and trying to better their skills, and then also a way to that's maybe more focused towards youth and kids that are getting better. For some of the most important things that I would recommend doing are simply just being self-aware, recognizing where you're at and your skills. I was discussing earlier kind of the difference between getting faster and just being able to go fast longer. Mm-hmm. I think that that is a very important step for people to recognize if they want to maybe adapt this into a racing scene, or maybe not just racing, just getting faster on a motorcycle. Recognize where your weaknesses are. I think in a lot of the generation that's growing up, the younger generation going through the motorcycle phase, they might get a lot of speed right at first, but not have that endurance to back it. There may be people that are on the complete opposite end of the spectrum that can ride for a long time and have endurance, but don't have that sprint speed yet. So being self-aware and recognizing where you're at, your weaknesses and your strengths can help you improve. If you can ride for 2 or 3 hours and you do great, but you just don't have where that moment where you can turn it on to 110% and sprint, then focus on that. Set up some turn tracks. Find a local motocross track. My favorite is just turn tracks. When I refer to turn tracks, I refer to anywhere where you're out in an open riding area where you can set up a mini track with lots of turns and just practice that. Practice awkward turns. Practice ruts. Practice different sections and focus on your sprint speed. Those may be some of the things that riders can focus on to improve that, being self-aware. Recognize where you're at with your fitness. Practice different techniques for form. I found something very interesting a couple months ago. Taylor Robert mentioned a post on his Instagram, and he recalled a moment that he had a couple years before that when he was riding with Kurt Caselli. And Kurt Caselli told Taylor Robert that the biggest riding flaw in his riding, the biggest flaw in his riding technique was his foot positioning. And this is something that all of us struggle with and that is very, very difficult to master. At my level of riding and racing, I practice this every single time I get on the motorcycle. I know and have read of retired pros that go back after their racing career and practice this same technique. There are all sorts of things that we can practice in our form and in our fitness, specifically our riding technique and our form, to become better riders. Pick those things that you want to practice one thing at a time and go over those. Now, a short stint for the youth. People ask me sometimes my favorite answer, and it's actually an answer that I guess my dad has helped me kind of form in my experience growing up and riding, is one of the best ways for youth, for younger riders to become a better rider, is to put them with friends or siblings of their same age and let them ride together. I have seen youth riders and young riders where you can literally watch the progress within hours, within laps, as they ride together without, I guess...
No coaching.
Yeah, no coaching. Not necessarily no supervision, but just no direct coaching. And not that coaching is not necessary. It's very necessary and can come in layers after that. But when they're 6, when they're 5, when they're 8 years old, putting them with riders of a similar skill level and a similar age and letting them enjoy what dirt bikes can bring to them is one of the absolute best ways for them to become better riders.
I love that you say that. I've seen that in my situation with my two boys. I don't get out with my boys nearly as much as I should, just everything that's going on. And there was a time where I put one of my boys onto a different bike, and he was immediately scared and intimidated by it. And it kind of took him back. We kind of took a few steps back by getting on that bike. And then the way that we got through that was on a camping trip. We were there with another family, and this other kid that's his same age had been riding that bike a little bit and was really gelling with it. And all it took was about a 2-hour ride. And my one son went from being terrified of the bike and thinking, I can't do this. Then he watched another kid his same age do these same trails on that bike. And 2 hours later, he was comfortable with the bike, and he progressed, you know, 2 months in 2 hours just by riding with a peer, which is really interesting to hear you say that.
And the key is that they're on a bike, not a four-wheeler.
Yeah.
Key distinction.
Yeah, exactly. So I love it. Well, this has been fascinating. One last thing, Josh, I want to hear what, and this may be hard for you, but just whatever comes to your mind. What is the best moment that you've ever had up to this point in your career on a dirt bike? What was it?
That's a loaded question for sure. When you first mentioned that, I have to think of some of the most recent riding experiences that I've had, and my wife may make fun of this or joke, because every time I get back from a ride or a race, she'll ask how was it, and I'll say it was the best ever. It was the best. And so there is truth to that, though, that almost every time I go out and ride, now there are hard days and there are hard races and there are rides that may not go as planned. But for the most part, I absolutely love every time I can get out and ride. And some of the most recent rides have been some of the absolute funnest times I've ever had on a dirt bike. Now, to maybe narrow that down into some more specific events or races or rides, I would honestly say that the ride that we did about 2 weeks ago with 9 friends in central Idaho for 4 days, riding 100 miles of perfect wet single track every day and not seeing a single other person for 4 days, was one of the best riding trips I've ever been on. Some of my absolute favorite racing moments were at this year's Idaho City. Idaho City is an enduro race in the city of Idaho City, up in Idaho, and the conditions were phenomenal, absolutely perfect temperatures, perfect dirt. We had 120 miles of pristine single track. I was racing with my dad. I was racing with my 2 brothers, all my friends, and we had an absolute blast. Those are the times that I have the most fun. Those are the times that I perform the best. I was just going back through some of my GoPro footage from that race and listening to myself just pretty much yell out in joy in the middle of the mountains racing my dirt bike because I was having so much fun. Another moment that stands out was a unique part of the ISDE is that the 6th and final day ends in a motocross test. And we all line up on a gate and do a traditional gate drop as in motocross. And I actually was able to win that moto. And that was one of the highlights of my racing career up to this point, was being able to win something like that in a foreign country at a race like that. After all that hard work, was something that was extremely special to me.
I love that. That is so cool. It's so fun to just think about where dirt bikes can take us. And here you are riding in multiple countries, you know, and at a high competitive level and just loving it. And then you also say, hey, some of the most fulfilling times were a couple weeks ago in Idaho with my family and friends. And that's something that is maybe I'm overstating this, but I think it's unique to this sport, you know. It's just something that we have that's special, you know, special in dirt bikes. I feel like I can relate to this whole camping thing. And every time I go someplace, I went to, I think, some of the similar areas that you did. I might have been there right before you did. We had a ton of dust when I was there, but it was still great. And I got back, and the conversations that I've had with my boys who are 9 and 11 is I say, hey, I found these cool places that I'm going to take you guys. You know, and my wife kind of cringes when she sees some of the footage and things, and she's like, you're not taking my boys there. But I'm like, no, we'll be fine. It'll be hard, but they're going to live, and we are going to create experiences together that I want them to remember their entire lives. And I can see by the look on your face that's what I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to get my sons to the point where they can come in to somebody's podcast, you know, 10, 15 years from now and say, hey, I did this thing with my dad and my brother, and it was the best thing ever. And I'm hoping to kind of build that.
Speaking of which, this last weekend, I know the race didn't really go in your favor. There was a Wendover Enduro with the USRA. Josh's chain broke, I think, in the first transfer section. So he didn't get to finish that one. And they actually canceled, or they called the race after one loop. But it started raining just a few minutes before the Enduro started. But my dad and my older brother, they both live out in California. My brother made, I think, close to 16 hours of drive time to come up to that. And then my dad drove out probably 11 hours just to do that one loop, pretty much. And they, neither of them had raced before, and they came back in. I was worried about them, worried if they'd make it back or if they'd ever want to get on a bike again. But they were both just so stoked to be out there and have us all there riding together. But it's crazy the bond that riding dirt bikes forms within your family. You know, it's true what they say, families that ride together stay together. So it's awesome to hear these great experiences with you guys, with the Knights. And I know that that you take your boys out quite a bit, and we've had the opportunity to ride with you and your boys. And I mean, those are the experiences that I know our kids look back on and will look back on and cherish. So,
yeah, it's expensive, but I feel like it's worth it. I, you know, some people say, well, how do you afford this or that? And the question is about priorities. You know, we don't take a lot of trips to Disneyland or whatever. We've been to those places, but, we prioritize on this thing, you know, and I don't have a BMW in the driveway, and that's, those are the decisions that you make. But I feel like it's going to pay dividends when you can teach the kids that, you know, I love all the life lessons that, you know, that Josh, you've been able to apply to your life and to your marriage and to your other relationships that have come from the challenges that we have in this sport. So I just want to thank you guys. It's been awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to stop by here. I think we've had a fascinating discussion. I've certainly learned a ton of things.
Oh, thank you, Kyle.
And I feel like our listeners are going to enjoy that. And yeah, any parting thoughts from either of you?
No, it's been great to be on here. You know, we've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of your viewers and listeners come by the shop. It's a great community that you've kind of formed on, you know, with the Dirt Bike Channel, both on the Facebook group, the YouTube channel, Instagram, and now this podcast. So it's exciting to see how it's going to continue to grow and develop. I mean, I'd like to, you know, offer your listeners and viewers, you know, through the end of the year, if you come to the shop or, you know, go to our website, themotoexperts.com, we'll offer a 10% off discount for suspension tuning setup service, and that's parts and labor, but that won't count towards shipping. And that'll just be through the end of 2019. Just mention Dirt Bike Channel and we'll get you hooked up.
Cool. I love it. In fact, down the road, I want to do a follow-up podcast with you, Kevin. Kevin, we'll talk about your shop. I'd love to just kind of, I've got a number of questions. I created an outline tonight in case we had enough time. We'll do that another time maybe,
sure.
But I think that'd be a fun follow-up podcast. And then Josh, good luck at ISDE. I mean, how do people get a hold of you? How do they follow you on social media? How do they hear about, how do they get plugged into what you're doing?
Well, first, thank you, Kyle. I really appreciate the opportunity you have given Kevin and I to come here today. This was awesome. I really enjoyed it. I think what you're doing is awesome for the sport, for the industry. I think you're doing a great job. You're a good example to so many people and so many individuals and families. You can find me, Josh Knight, on Instagram, Facebook, at Josh Knight, Josh Knight 962. You can find us also on YouTube and Instagram at Ride with the Knights. We are sharing content there. If you'd like to support me and our efforts in going to Portugal and participating in the ISDE, you can make a donation or purchase one of our t-shirts or hoodies. You can contact me through social media. there. Or you can follow the whole journey going to Europe and racing on our YouTube channel, Ride with the Knights, or on my Instagram. So we want to share this experience with everybody. We are extremely grateful for everybody that has supported us in this amazing journey. I am very grateful for Kevin and his willingness to provide a motorcycle and help us get there. And I'm extremely excited, and I'm ready to do it.
Cool. Well, we'll cut you guys loose, and we'll see you in the next episode. Thanks, everybody.